Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
Are we live? What's happening, folks? Welcome to the Most High Show. This is David Cleope again, every Tuesday night at 7. And we have the honor today to talk with somebody from the other side of the coast, from California. We're over here in Atlanta, so it's good to be able to reach out through the digital world and get some good perspective and get a little bit of what my man is doing. His name is Yeshaya Blakeney. Welcome to the show, Yeshaya.
Thank you, baby.
Appreciate you for appreciate having you on. Now, what we usually do on the Most High on Tuesday nights, it's usually based around stories, right?
Sure.
People's, you know, recovery story, you know,
sure,
from the past, you know, their bottom to now. However, sure, we're fortunate and blessed to sometimes have somebody that has a background in the field, and sure, we'd love to be able to talk with you about your perspective on recovery and sure, your approach and everything like that. So sure, so where are you living at in California right now?
I'm in West Los Angeles.
West Los, yeah, Angeles, all right. Yeah. And now another thing is you are a co-founder, right? You want to go off of that? What are you co-founder?
I started a place called Recover Integrity. It's a long-term treatment program, substance abuse dual diagnosis program for men.
Okay.
In 2015, prior to that, I worked at the charity level in treatment at a nonprofit for 13 years. So I've basically been working in recovery since I was 22 years old.
Wow.
30 in a couple of months. And as anybody knows who works in the field, it's blessed work. It's hard.
It's hard. Yeah.
A lot of kind of, you know, stuff comes up, especially if you're a caring person.
Oh man.
You know what I mean? But,
definitely, time, you know, you see somebody go way up here and then all of a sudden, where are they at?
Or they can't get way up here.
Yeah. Or they just get, they're struggling the whole way through. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get it. But you know, everybody says, you know, if you watch Instagram, everybody's apparently looking for meaning and purpose.
Yes. So,
you know, we get a lot of meaning and purpose. That's the payoff. And I happen to be able to make a living doing it as well. So that's a real blessing.
That is a blessing. Now, yeah. So if you don't mind me asking, so, you know, I really would like to get your perspective on, I'd like to get information. Okay. And sure, the first thing that interests me is, what does it look like? What does recovery look like? Let's say, okay, somebody hits bottom. Okay. And they're, yeah, looking for treatment. Maybe, yeah, they're a cocaine addict, heroin, whatever they're addicted to, right? They don't, sure, have no money. They don't have no insurance. How, sure, what happens in LA? How does it go down?
Sure. Got it. Well, so first, I think bottom is an interesting, yeah, concept.
Okay.
You know? And, yeah, so I like to define things.
Sure.
You know, there's a kind of a lot of sayings in recovery culture. Mm-hmm. And one of the sayings is the bottom is when you stop digging.
Okay.
You know, it's not like there's some objective bottom out there.
Right.
Bottom,
right, right,
is, I mean, often what it looks like, if it's sort of, you know, if you're not in court and the judge says you have to go to treatment or whatever, it looks like kind of a moment when you wake up and go, oh man, I can't do this anymore.
This has got to stop.
You know,
yeah,
that doesn't mean you stop. Sometimes, right, people wake up and say, I can't do this anymore. And that, you know, and sometimes they pick up the phone and, you know, but I like to define, you know, bottom is about an internal experience. You know, my bottom was, I was handcuffed on a curb. Pico was not the first time I had been handcuffed. Mm-hmm. I knew it was about to go down in a serious way.
Right.
And I felt like I had been fighting the world my whole life.
Okay.
And I lost. And I was like, all right, world, you win. You know, I get whatever, like, yeah, whatever I got to do, I give up. You know what I mean? And that was my experience with bottom. But, you know, I think a lot of people come to recovery have their own experience of what a bottom is.
Right. It's not a laid out
term. Not a, yeah,
it's different for everybody, I guess.
It's a personal
experience. It's that moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's an important moment. Experience. And it's interesting to think about that there are bottoms, but there aren't tops.
Mm.
You know,
right,
you're so always, that's like, well, the reason, because you just, you can keep working for more and more, you know, to be at a higher and higher spiritual frequency.
Right.
You know, to have more joy, more love. There's no top.
That's a forever thing. You know? You're always
climbing. You get as high as you can get, you know, yeah. the most high, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. But anyways, so your question, you know, that's actually one of the things I spend a lot of my time doing is helping people just in that scenario. You know, they have some experience or a loved one goes, hey, my partner here is not hitting the bottom, but he needs help.
Can you please help him or something like that?
So we're a private treatment program. So for us, either you have to know somebody there that's got a scholarship.
So they're processed to get you. There's insurance involved and all that kind of stuff.
You got to get in. You know what I mean?
Right.
But that being said, I take a lot of calls and I worked in the nonprofit charity level for a long time, which basically, you know, you made an appointment, you came in, you had to get in treatment. But, you know, basically what you want to do is there's three things I look at with treatment.
Right.
I mean, not everybody needs to go to treatment to get clean. You know, some people can go to Alcoholics Anonymous and start working a program. People can go to Celebrate Recovery, Refuge Recovery, Smart Recovery. There's a lot of support systems out there that aren't treatment. There are sober livings. I am a huge advocate of the sober living model, you know, because I think really recovery happens where you live. Therapy is great. I'm a big advocate of therapy. We have therapy. I love group work. And, you know, I've been working in treatment for a long time. In the end, if somebody has just a little bit of resources, if there's a good, solid, structured sober living,
right,
that somebody can move into for 6 months or a year that'll cost you the same as 2 weeks in treatment.
Yeah.
I'm a big advocate of that. So what I look at for people is, what is the best support for your situation? What's your situation? What's the best support for your situation for the longest time that it's available within the financial constraints of your situation? And so for me, you know, let's say somebody has $3,000, okay?
Yeah.
I'm not going to say go do a week of outpatient treatment, you know what I mean, for $3,000. I'm going to say, hey, go find a good sober living for $700 a month.
Right.
That has some structure, 12-step meetings, good community with a good owner who's real hands-on. Mm-hmm. You can go move in there for 4 or 5 months. You get 4 or 5 months of treatment, community, job, you know, stuff like that. So it's kind of an equation. It's different for everybody.
Right.
Some people, you know, need some kind of like pretty serious clinical care.
Yeah.
You know, if you have dual diagnosis or something like that.
That does answer my question. And it's pretty similar, you know, out here. You and I, we have a lot of similarities in our career paths. You know, I'm a counselor and I work outreach. So I'm often picking up guys from trap houses that don't have anything. The whole, you know, the inpatient residential is out of the question. Yeah. So it's like, you know, we got to get you to a detox and then we get you to a good sober living environment, you know, a structure that's, that's going to help you, that you get the community for the most part has a pretty good. Yeah. Because, you know, communities go, you know, the group can go down and up, but the ones that stay, you know, I really look for the ones that are as steady as they can be because of, you know, the structure within it. So that's really cool, man. Now that's funny that you say that, because I think what happens to guys like you that take a lot of calls that work for a place like Recovery Integrity, you oftentimes probably become a resource and referral for guys.
It's one of my favorite things to do. Right. I'll tell you why. You know, well, first of all, I work nonprofit, you know what I mean? So when I started working in treatment, I was making $9 an hour, which in LA, it's like $1 an hour. you know what I mean? Yeah. And I got three kids. I got another kid on the way. I mean, I'm not a single man. And I worked my way up to $14 an hour, you know, seven, 8 years later, you know what I mean? But I'm in my 30s with kids, you know, trying to get by in LA.
I feel you right here.
Yeah. So it is what it is. So I made the move into for-profit, which is a big deal for me. My parents used to run nonprofit treatment programs, not substance abuse, but mental health level 14.
And you know what? I know we're going to jump back to that because that's really interesting too. So we're going to hit that off before the end. Okay.
So for me, there was a lot of guilt in going into making money while helping at the same time. You know, I'm happy to be transparent about that, you know? And so one of the beautiful things is I get calls from people all the time. Just, you know, they found us online or whatever, and they might not be a good fit or whatever. Right. And I can help them set up a treatment plan and find the right resource in 3 minutes.
Yeah.
It would take them 2 years to figure it out because they don't have my knowledge basis and my experience.
Your knowledge and your networking, right?
And the internet is ridiculous. I mean, yeah. If you try to find treatment on the internet, it's a joke. Everybody's selling everything. It's so shady. Yeah. And so just if somebody gets on me, they're like, thank you so much. Nobody's talking to me. Nope.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, what's the situation? Dual diagnosis, this, that. What's your, don't do that. Here's your, talk to this person, you know. And I love doing that because it's, what is it? It's an hour and a half of my time a day.
Right.
But I'm saving people months and years.
That's really
so easy for me. And it's a good benefit for them. I love it. It's
well, it has to be as just as helpful as the people that helping somebody get put somewhere that you know, custom fitting these guys that are, you know, making a treatment plan for somebody that doesn't Absolutely. Have anything has got to be just as beneficial.
It's great, man.
To you as the people that you're helping inside.
And I don't have
treatment.
To be responsible for him for 6 months. I just put like, this dude is great. You know, let's call him.
right. So right now, I think this is a good time. Let's go back a little bit to, you know, your background a little bit. So we know that you're a co-founder of Recover Integrity. That,
yeah, it's Recover Integrity.
I'm sorry. Recover Integrity.
That's cool.
You know, we got some of that background. Let's go back to, you know, to what inspired you to, I hate saying that word on a talk show. What inspired you?
That's no, but, cool. No,
you know, what pushed you into, you know, that line of business?
Yeah.
Helping people and serving and all that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it depends on where we want to start. If we start with like when I started working in treatment or when I got sober myself, I'm in recovery myself. So
I think that let's go back there.
Got it. So, you know, my background is I come from a long line of alcoholics. That's what I mean. The relevant background is, you know, my father's alcoholic. My grandfather, his father, name is PC, rest in peace. He was a wino and he died of alcoholism.
Okay.
Now, my dad has 13, 14 brothers and sisters. He has 13 of them, 12 of them are addicts and alcoholics, you know, including him.
Right. So it's in your family. Definitely.
It's in my line.
It's in your DNA, right?
Yeah. For a long time, for quite a few generations. You know, so I grew up in a house where I actually grew up in a great environment, you know, in my opinion. You know, it was dysfunctional in one regard with the alcoholism and the codependence with my mom.
Right.
Alcoholism with my dad, codependence with my mom. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my parents were educated people.
Yeah.
They're psychologists. They worked nonprofit. They were baby boomers, social justice.
Activists.
You know, civil rights. Yeah. They were active in Berkeley, California is where I'm from.
Oh, wow. Oakland, yeah.
California. So they were really you know, out to change the world.
Yeah.
And a lot of music and appreciation of art and culture in my house. So we had a nice home, you know, and everything was pretty cool. And my father was an alcoholic, you know, and he was a functional alcoholic until he didn't function anymore.
Yeah.
And then he was a dysfunctional alcoholic and also used some drugs and stuff like that.
Sure.
And in the time that I grew up in the 80s, and the early 90s in Oakland and Berkeley, everybody got loaded. I mean, anybody, we would listen to hip hop, you know, Tupac, Biggie, I'm of that generation.
Yeah.
And we all sold weed. We all smoked weed. We all drank. We all partied.
It was the culture. It was part of the culture, man. It was just
if you weren't square, that's just what you did, you know? And you didn't, you know, when we were younger, it was like, you know, you don't do hard drugs. That's for drug addicts.
Yeah.
But, you know, we kick it. So I grew up in that kind of culture.
Drinking 40s. Drinking 40s and smoking 40s, blunts, right?
Yeah, Mickey's and, you know, Odie.
Some large mouth. Yeah, I get it. I see it on the West Coast.
St. Ives.
Yeah.
St. Ives. You know
the crooked. Yeah, I get it.
Mad Dog 2020.
Started
with the Pepper Bitch anyways.
Right.
Yeah, so anyways, I started getting loaded when I was like 12, you know, 11, 12, smoking weed and drinking and partying. That wasn't the first time I had a drink, but that was when I really started getting into it. And and immediately I just loved it because I was always a mischievous, I still am, you know, like part of my personality is kind of mischievous and funny and creative. And I like to fuck around, you know.
You're an artist. Like, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so really into that, but, you know, immediately started, you know, not taking care of my responsibilities and made some commitments like, yeah, okay, it's okay to smoke weed and drink. And we used to do mushrooms and stuff like that because, you know, it's Berkeley, but we'll never do cocaine or, you know, any of that kind of hard stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was 15, My dad was doing hard drugs and wasn't really in my house anymore.
Okay.
I was kind of starting to get a little.
So the house is separated a little bit now, right?
Yeah, he was like running around in the hood. He was like running around the hood with his cousins.
Gotcha.
It was pretty hectic. I mean, I don't even remember it that well anymore, but it was pretty hectic. And so my mom was concerned about me and this kind of stuff. And I was starting to kind of trip. You know, I was getting a little harder into my own trip.
You're heading that. You're starting to live a little while.
Headed in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
But basically I threw a party and a bunch of cats came over to the house and there was like a gunfight in front of my house over some girl. My mom came back and she sent me to live with my uncle in Beverly Hills.
Oh, right after that happened, it's like, you're out of here.
Like the Fresh Prince of Beverly Hills. See you later. almost the exact same story, to be honest with you. And so I moved in with him, and in LA, you know, I was in a kind of a wealthier part of LA and I didn't really fit in.
Right.
And so I just sort of took on the identity of like the street punk, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I started running with those cats and, you know, doing little kind of burglaries and getting loaded and doing parties and just, I took on kind of a negative self-identity, I call it, you know?
Yeah.
I always did hip hop and rapped, and that was, you know, always a thing for me. And I started doing drugs too, doing ecstasy and cocaine and meth. And
so it starts,
I started breaking commitments.
Yeah.
I didn't have any integrity at the time. So it wasn't like I'd make a commitment, but you know, it wasn't like I was good for it. You know what I mean? And it's a common story. You know, I started getting arrested a lot and was always on probation. And then we'd get arrested on probation and we'd go to jail for a couple of days.
Right.
And, you know, constantly just trying to figure out how to stay out of trouble, not doing much productive. I was totally lost. I mean, like the story that always sticks with me is I don't know if I was 19 or 17. I don't remember. But I was sitting down with the probation officer and she looks at my file, you know, which was getting thicker at the time. And she says, so what are you doing like with your life? And I just remember being like, oh, I'm going to SMC. SMC is Santa Monica College, right?
Okay.
Taking a couple classes and I'm doing my music thing. She was like, what about the other 35 hours during the week? And I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to school. And she's like, I had just terrible answers to really basic questions. But to me, it made sense. And I just remember her going, you know, based on your file and your answers to my questions, I predict that you're going to get arrested, you know, or some shit like that.
Right.
And I remember thinking, excuse my language, I thought to myself, like, you don't know me. You know what I mean? Like, what are you talking about? But she knew me better than I knew myself.
Way better, because
I just was.
Man, if we would have listened to that person.
Unbelievable.
You know? Yeah.
I mean, why I didn't go, tell me why you think that. Yeah. You know, just too arrogant. You know, you're narcissistic, you're arrogant. Anyways, so first time I went to rehab, I was 17 years old. And I wasn't ready, you know. And basically, I think that's kind of an important place to pause for people that are going to treatment. You know, it seems like a simple idea. Like, it is simple. Like, I wasn't ready to get sober.
Yeah.
But what that means is I didn't understand. I didn't have a level of awareness to understand what my problem was and what it was going to take to actually change. And so I was so used to avoiding responsibility and avoiding things that are uncomfortable without even thinking about it, that for me, as soon as I went to that rehab, you know, I'd be sitting in a meeting, I'm looking at the clock going, man, when can I smoke a cigarette? You know, the counselor's like, hey man, I want you to write your drug history. I'm thinking like, I don't do homework.
Right.
You know?
So you're like, so you're like, you know, there's all that. There's like rebellion in there, right? There's ignorance in there because you just know, you know, you're not hip to anything in recovery. And there's probably not even really at that time, is there even a want to really change your life?
You know, I didn't even understand what that meant. You know, there was a want to not deal with the BS.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys cuss on here or not, you know, that want was there, but I didn't have enough vision to go, oh, you know, there's such a thing as a meaningful life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if somebody were to talk to me, like I'm talking to you, I would have been like, what are you talking about, man?
Meaningful life. What does that even mean?
Meaningful life. Yeah. I mean, okay. It sounds like a nice book or something, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but I couldn't see it. And so I have a lot of empathy for youngsters in particular. They don't have to be. A lot of times young people,
right?
They can't see how life unfolds over the years and how precious time is, and like, man, if you can get it when you're younger, you know what I mean? It's like, wow,
what a head start.
man, yeah. what a head start. You know what I mean? So, cause I was there, I didn't get it, you know? And as an example, like I was, you know, a cognitive distortion. So I was a 30 day program. I left at 21 days.
Okay? You rolled out.
And I'm planning on staying sober. Now I relapsed on my third day, but I didn't really think about it. You know, while I was there, I smoked some weed, I sniffed some pills or whatever. Yeah. I'm thinking I want to be sober, but I'm relapsing in the treatment. I leave, I tell my friends who don't care, hey man, I'm sober now. Okay. So I'm thinking like, I'm going to be sober, yeah. right?
Because you're stating it. Yo, I'm sober.
Saying, I'm now they don't care one way or the other if I'm sober or not. Right. They get loaded. So then, oh, sorry, hang on one second. I didn't get this right. Oh man, I don't know how to do this. Hang on, let me get it. So then I'm thinking, okay, so I go to this party and somebody hands me a cup of some alcohol. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm sober. And they're like, oh, man, it's cool. I was like, oh, all right, you know what? I'm just going to drink. So I immediately switched the definition of sobriety to abstinence from everything to I can drink, just not do drugs.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, I had an alcohol problem. So how in my own head that worked, I don't even know. So then I'm drinking. Then my buddy can't roll a blunt, asked me to roll it. I rolled a blunt. He goes, oh, you know, we used to say you roll it, you light it, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I'm not. And he's like, no, that's cool. I was like, all right. And I'm just, you know, my first day out. But for 2 months, I'm walking around telling people I'm sober. Not probation officers, like my friends. And I'm getting loaded. So that's how kind of confused I was. And I think a lot of people are like that. Like, they kind
of
don't even
I can see that all the time. People hiding that part of them. Yeah, right. Yeah, because you've already made the statement. No, and if you're doing it, you're... Yeah. Like not being honest, you're lying to your homies.
You kind of just don't know what the hell is going on.
Yeah,
you know. So that was me. Anyway, so you know what ended up happening is a couple years later, I got busted for trafficking marijuana back when that was illegal out here. Mm-hmm. It's legal out here now. It was not at the time. And it was a large quantity. And I wasn't really like a dope dealer. I just, you know, I did things here now and then type of thing. And I was trying to make a move that was way too big for somebody like me to be making, you know, given the kind of person I was. And so I get busted and I'm facing 4 years in prison and I get bailed out of jail. And I check myself into this nonprofit treatment program.
Oh, was that because you wanted to, or was that like by like your maybe a bail bondsman or a PO said something to you, or it was just like, man,
I got to do something. I was trying not to do 4 years in prison.
So you're trying to go that route. Look like a good dude the whole way.
I don't want to say I had no intentions of changing.
Right.
That's not what I was thinking about. I was like, man, I'm not trying to go do 4 years.
Yeah, I'm doing whatever it takes to look good in front of the judge. Come sentencing day. Yeah.
I mean, some people don't mind, you know, they'll go do it, but I was trying to figure out how not to do it if possible. So I go to this place and I talk to the attorney. The attorney's like, listen, you can go to treatment all you want, but given your record and, you know, like what's going on, like you're going to do at least a year.
Yeah.
So that's cool. You know what I mean? You can go to treatment, but you're still going to do at least a year because it was a pretty serious charge. And I had a bit of a history. So I go into treatment program. I make a deal with God. Mm. I say, God, look, check me out.
Okay.
I'm going to get sober. I'm going to tell the truth. I'm going to be a good person.
All right.
You try to help me stay out of prison. You know, they call that a foxhole prayer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know? And that was my deal. And I did it. I mean, I stopped lying, started telling the truth. I showed up to all the groups. I started to help people. I got a sponsor. I worked the 12 steps. And 6 months later, I'm in front of the judge. And basically the DA had said to me, listen, man, you know, you're going to do at least a year. My attorney said that, the DA said that, and I get to court and the DA goes, the judge is sick. The judge is sick. She's like, we got a substitute judge. He said, the normal judge, would not give you alternative sentencing and you would be going to prison. But this judge probably open to that.
Well, God was looking out.
You got to take a felony.
Yeah.
You got to take the felony. You're going to have a suspended sentence. So if you mess up, you know, you're going to go do 4 years. But we will give you court order treatment 6 months.
Wow. And, what a blessing that was, man. You missed that train.
Hey, man. And I said yes. And I went back to that treatment program. I stayed in that treatment program for another 6 months, 7 months.
Same one.
13 cool. months. I did 13 months of treatment. I was court ordered for six. And I didn't want to. I had a place to go. I had a condo. Mm-hmm. I was like, at that point, I had kind of woken up.
Yeah.
And was like, no, I need the help. I didn't really even care. I was like, I'll do whatever I need to do I got to get my life together.
Right. So would you say it was, you know, because 13 months is, that's a good time to be in treatment, yeah. right? So I guess, would it be true to say that through that process, you gained like a different purpose, a different perspective,
So it was humility.
Yeah.
You know, I was scared as hell. You know, I owed the Hell's Angels like $20,000 and I'm facing 4 years in prison. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I was like, oh man, I remember I went to sleep that night when all this stuff went down. I didn't want to wake up. I mean, this wasn't cool.
Right.
And so that fear was a bottom, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, I got nowhere to go. And that bottom created in me some humility.
Mm-hmm.
And that humility was, oh my God, I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah.
Like, period. In my life. I don't know how life works. Like any of it. But it's funny because you walk around pretending like you know that. You know what I mean?
That is funny. You're walking.
Especially when you're young. Yeah. Especially when you're young, you know. I was young. I was 21,
like, you know something. Know?
Yeah, I thought I knew more than everybody.
Yeah.
You know? Like a lot of people do, you know. And so reality was brought close to me and it bred some humility. And I kind of looked around and was like, oh man, I don't know how to live at all. Like, I don't know what fork to eat with. I don't know how to fill out an application. I don't know how to open a bank account. I don't know how to fold my clothes appropriately.
Right.
Like, I don't know anything, you know. But I see people that do know how to do those. And it was like, suddenly I woke up like, there are people that know things that I don't know. Oh my God. You know,
let me start seeing what he's doing
in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was, before that I was just disengaged.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So somebody tried to, a therapist or a probation officer or whatever, tried to talk to me. I wouldn't even engage, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, so what happened was honest engagement, but you know, sometimes you're not awake enough to honestly engage. Like, sometimes you're just your ego.
Right. You're just mad ignorant to even like have ears to like take in.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of information.
You're not there.
Yeah,
you're not there. I wasn't there my first time. You could have talked to me. You know, it wouldn't have mattered.
Right.
You know, unless you put a gun to my head or something. Like, right. I couldn't hear you. So there was, you know, I think when in AA, when they talk about a spiritual awakening and not just AA, I mean, I think in general, what a spiritual awakening is, it's a level up of consciousness.
Mm.
And so it's sort of like you're living at one, let's call it structural dimension, the way that you're thinking. I have a lot of examples of it. And even in developmental psychology, you know, we can talk about spiritually, you talk about it psychologically, mm-hmm. there are structures of thought, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as an example, I have a seven-year-old. My seven-year-old can't do multiplication.
Okay.
Structure of the mind that requires the abstract thinking to do multiplication doesn't exist in him yet. Do you know what I mean? That's why they don't teach multiplication to 7 years.
Right.
They teach arithmetic. You know what I mean? Because it takes a while for you to be able to understand abstraction at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are levels, you know, or I call them sometimes frequencies of consciousness and thought and complexity of thought, you know?
Right.
And the construct of recovery actually is kind of complicated, you know, and to become a person in recovery, you know, I think it's hard to do that in an intentional way when you're 15, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just like you said, you have, you know, you feel for the younger guys that you come across that are, because they're just, you know, they just don't have the capacity yet. It's just not
to get it
there.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not there yet, you know?
And even just like, I remember a counselor when I was in treatment. So like, there were times when I would drink a 22 and wash my car and that was it. Nothing bad happened. I didn't get drunk. You know, I drank a 22. I walked my car. I went inside, smoked some weed, watched some NYPD Blue, whatever the deal was.
And that was life. Yeah.
And, you know, in the AA book, they basically say every time you drink, you know, if you're, this is a bit of a bastardization of it, but mm-hmm. but it's close to every time you drink, you can't stop. And I'm thinking, well, man, what about the time where I would have that 22 and wash my car? And, you know, that wasn't, maybe I'm not an alcoholic.
Right.
And I remember this counselor comes to me and he says, actually in group. And he said, anybody who thinks they can drink, I'll take you to the bar right now. Let's take a shot of alcohol and see if you can stop there and come back to this treatment program. And in my head, I'm thinking, this dude trying to trick me. I'm court ordered. Like, I'm not going for this, you know. Right. But I raised my hand. I said, listen, this is engagement, by the way. I raised my hand, right? So it means I'm engaging with him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actively in the group. I raised my hand. I said, listen, I'm not going to do that with you right now. I was like, but if you're asking, do I think I could walk down the street with you, take a shot at the bar, walk back here and come sit in this group? I'm like, yeah, I think I could do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking like, I'm not an alcoholic. And he goes, do you think you could do it 2 days in a row with two shots? Yeah, I had to pause, you know, for a second and think about it because I had blacked out, you know, 1,000 times.
Yeah, yeah.
2,000 times, you know. And I said, you know, it's a little trickier, but I think I could do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, you must be an alcoholic then. I said, why is that? So I could think I did. And he said, because you just think you can do it. And somebody who's not an alcoholic knows they can.
Wow.
I mean, I was 21.
That's
but,
deep.
But, think, but like, I, first of all, a year before that, I would have never even raised my hand in group.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, man, fuck this guy. Excuse me. F this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I, like, those are the kind of thoughts I had. Like, so I raised my hand. That's first of all. I asked an honest question. I gave my honest
That's
opinion
a big
about
move.
Something.
Now,
he gave me an honest answer.
You're participating now.
I didn't right. do that before yeah. at all. I was totally, right. we call it morally disengaged.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me an honest answer. It's almost 20 years later. I still remember it.
Oh, that hit the right spot.
I was just
that
like,
sunk
okay.
in.
Yeah. Because to this day, I don't know if I can do that.
You know? Absolutely, man.
I got to be honest.
I can't say no to that. I'm, you know, I've been in sobriety for a little bit, yeah. you know, but yeah. I couldn't say, yeah, of course. You know, that's the difference. I mean, that's a very true, that's a true statement, man.
So I got sober in treatment. It was good for me, man. I hung out with a bunch of people 15 years older than me. So I came in and I always did that even when I was yeah. running around, you know,
getting like, that wisdom.
I always like to be around older people, yeah. you know, like young people do. And they were like, you know, here's the sponsor, here's the steps, here's the deal. It wasn't a lot of conversation. Mm-hmm. There was no therapy to the place that I went. And it was 12 step. And it was community and it was getting sober with your peoples. So, and I just did it. And then there were kind of, you know, moments of moral conflict where I had to choose sure. what the right thing to do was. And,
yeah.
you know, where I got to grow and exercise the right thing in a difficult time and moment, there were temptations and, you know, and I stayed in a lot of support and stuff like that. And
I mean, then, that's a great time. I mean, that's a, yeah. you're in a good place to go through those things though. Like if you're giving like the rooms and the steps and you're starting to apply them in your life when you come to like, and that's for it. I mean, in my opinion, anybody going through life, if you had the structure of the 12 steps and just,
yeah,
you know, what's 100%. The principles in there, whatever you're facing. I mean, you're in a good position. You're in a good spot.
You're in a good position.
Yeah. Cause you're going to have support. You're going to have knowledge. You're going to have people that care.
And you're morally engaged.
Yeah. I mean, and you're a part of
like,
it.
Listen, I was the kind of person that, you know, whether it was cheating on my significant other or stealing from somebody, I didn't even wrestle with it.
Yeah.
I just was like, you know, kind of like an animal, you know, like I just did what I do. You
no
know
thought
I mean?
To it. Yeah.
No thought to it. And so, you know, the 12 steps are challenging you to stay morally engaged. Like, what kind of person are you? Where's your care? You know, it's about right. morality. It's about moral psychology, it says at the beginning of that book. And, you know, ironically, my parents were moral psychologists, but I was very morally disengaged yeah. for yeah. most of my life.
Right.
And then I became morally engaged. And really my you know, my the foundation of my spirituality is really rooted in 12 step. It's grown yeah. in a lot of different ways since then, but,
mm-hmm.
but, excuse me, foundationally as an adult, it was really 12 step recovery. So then I was doing hip hop music and I was a counselor during the day.
Okay.
So I was doing counseling at the
counselor during the day, hip hop at night.
Doing shows.
Bars at night.
Band, I mean, well, rapping.
Yep. Rapping bars yep. at night.
Yeah. I was staying sober, going to bars, doing
lyrical bars,
going to the studio.
Yeah.
It was great. And I got, I had a girlfriend and we got married and had a kid when I was like 23.
Mm-hmm.
I had another kid 4 years later, another kid 4 years later, and just, you know, kept working the streaming program and eventually left and started Recover Integrity. And the motivation to start Recover Integrity, some of it was I looked around at the treatment landscape in Los Angeles, and there was a lot of treatment, but there wasn't a lot of good treatment. And in some ways, there were things about nonprofit charity treatment that I like better than private treatment. Okay. You know? So like to this day, I probably think a good sober living is more valuable for somebody staying sober than a good outpatient.
Yeah.
To this day, I believe that. And I own a treatment program. And I own sober living and,
well, that's
and an outpatient.
You know, to me, I mean, you know, like I, you know, like I said earlier, you know, you have to skip it in a lot of people's cases, right? Because you just can't afford it, you know? And
for sure.
You know, unless there's a scholarship available, you know, there's, you know, if you don't have any money, man, it's difficult to get to that.
But even if you can't, so I'll be like, here's the game, in my opinion.
Okay.
The game is, let's say middle class people that have health insurance or upper class people that have money or, you know, whatever that is, people that can afford treatment. They want, the loved ones want to be told that there's a type of therapy out there
that'll fix them. Yeah.
That's going to fix the kid.
Yeah.
And so if you go on any treatment website, including mine, there's a list of therapeutic services.
Right.
Now, do I think the vast majority, and I mean, by the way, I had this conversation with parents. So this is for me, like, I just try to be as real as possible about it. How many people do I think really DBT was the core of them getting sober? It's not nobody, but it ain't even any, I don't even think it's not in the double digits of percentage either.
Right.
How many people it was like this specific trauma treatment? I really don't think so, man. I really think it's the immersion in the community and the relationships that you build and your readiness for change.
Yeah.
Your willingness to sacrifice.
Right. That's where it all.
I just never seen it work any other way.
Yeah.
Man.
The success, regardless of what's in front of you for the help, if you have like this, you know, this want to change, if you find this want to change. And I think, you know, whenever you talk about you going through that long treatment program, right? And this is what and this is what I think there's value in that, you know, because, you know, I would say for you, it was more of a gradual experience, a learning experience to get.
That's exactly right.
You know, so I think there is, but again, you know, a lot of people have to skip that outpatient, right? And they go from maybe a detox or a jail or whatever, and they go straight to a sober living. Yeah. There is so I believe there's so much value in there, and it's definitely in the community, right? And people that are 100%. Working programs, and 100%. You know, people are seeing people care for you and relate to you. You know, it's like a community group affair that's really 100%. Helpful. You know.
I want to tell you one crazy thing about that.
Sure.
So there's a friend of mine, his name is David Vandervelt. And there was a program out here called Liberty House. It was a charity program. A lot of people coming out of prison, stuff like that. They got you writing on the chalkboard, kind of old school. You know, you get words and stuff when you
break
the
rule. Man, I haven't seen a chalkboard in a long time.
Oh, but they still do that, man. They still do it. So anyways, it turned into a program called Awakening Recovery. Started by this guy, David, and I know some of the people on the board and stuff like that. And when they're opening up, I was, you know, kind of helping them, trying to support them because I thought it was a good thing they were doing.
Right.
And it's a year-long program. It's a sober living. It's in like right Beverly Hills adjacent. It's in a nice neighborhood. It costs zero, right? You can live there for a year. Hardcore 12-step behavioral program. You work the 12 steps in all your affairs, right?
Right.
The success rate of that program, if you complete it, which is a year, is 90%. It is the most successful program in Los Angeles if you complete it. So think about this. There's programs out here that cost $80,000 a month. And not just like one or two. There's like five of them.
All right.
$80,000 a month. And my program's not cheap. It ain't $80,000 a month, but it's not cheap. The success rate of those programs, quite honestly, is the same as everywhere else. You know, it's like 15%, 12%, whatever, right? If you complete the program.
Right.
this program costs nothing. It's not even a program. It's a sober living.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's got the highest success rate out of any treatment program. So what that means is, you don't, it's not about how much money you have. It's going to allow you to get sober. Mm-hmm. In fact, money can get in your way. And it's not like you can buy your way into the best program in the world.
Right.
There's only so many tools. If you've got psychosis or schizophrenia, there's like four drugs.
Yeah.
You've got depression, there's like five different types of medication. You got addiction, you got to work a program and change who you hang out with and what you do. You don't need a lot of money to do any of that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, you know, it kind of like leads me into the question. We're kind of touching on it right now, but I'd like to get, a straight response to, why do you think that success numbers are low in treatment?
Yeah. So I think there's quite a few factors. Mm-hmm. I think we sort of danced around this.
Yeah, I think we're touching on it and touching on it. So,
first of all, I think for most people, the commitment. Now, whether that's the commitment to like I'm doing 90 and 90,
right,
or whether it's the commitment of going to sober living or treatment, it doesn't matter. The amount of time that it takes to get your feet under you in sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody even likes to say this. Like on our website, it says 90 days. You know what I mean? We have a 90-day program. People stay longer than 90 days.
Right. But
we're sort of like, hey, like we don't do the 30-day thing. You know what I mean? 90-day program.
At least 90 days is what you're saying, right?
Yeah. And by the way, that's only because if we said 9 months, we'd scare the shit out of you.
Yeah, nobody. Come. Nobody's coming.
Nobody would ever come. Right. They'd never come. You know what I mean? But the reality is it takes like 9 months to a year to get your feet under you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like that's really the reality. When I look at my staff or people I know that have been sober, it's like, man, they were engaged hardcore in like pretty intensive support, whatever that was and whatever form that took for like, you know, 9 months to a year.
Yeah.
A lot of people, whether that was in jail, whether it was in sober living, whether it was in a treatment program, some combination thereof.
Right.
It was like, it took a lot of time. So I think one of the reasons is our society is not structured in such a way that people are like, all right, I'm just going to go like take 9 months. And you know what I mean? People always trying to get back to life. It's like, I got to get back, man. I got things to do.
As soon as they get in, I got to get a job.
The ego comes back. I got to get money. I got to get back. I got to do this, you know? So
they think recovery is like having a job.
Exactly right.
You know?
Exactly right. So I think that's one reason. The other reason is that, you know, recovery is like diet or exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like I look at it like this, like there's a gym out here called LA Fitness. I don't know if you guys have those out there or like 24 Hour Fitness.
Yeah.
So those gyms, they sign up like 2,500 people, right? That's how they make money. More. They sign up like 4,000 or 5,000 people for gym memberships. But they know that only 10% of the people are actually going to go to the gym. And so they realize that their whole model is built on the idea that people make commitments they don't keep.
Yeah.
When it comes to working out or when it comes to dieting, right?
Right.
Recovery is just like that. You know what I mean? People sign up or a parent signs up or whatever happens, you get signed up. But the consequences of it's not like not showing up to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
People fizzle out.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so you have to have a really deep change transformational experience to say, I'm willing to sustain a different way of life for the rest of my life. It's a really hard thing to do. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So, you know, so what I'm getting out of this is, you know, regardless of what's out there, what's offered, commitment, right?
It's commitment.
The open-mindedness and willingness to do like whatever it takes, man, and to learn.
100%.
Right?
100%.
And then when you get to the good part of that is, I can attest to that in my own story. You know, I was in and out of rehabs, these little 28 days here. I do, a long term detox or something like that. And I'd really think I had a chance to like get out and stop. But it wasn't until I was like forced, you know, through an institution, right? Yeah. To do like it was almost like a over 6 month program.
Yeah.
But then after that I was still
in aftercare of some kind.
I was in that environment still. Yeah, like exactly. I was in that structure thing where I could really work on me. So it definitely took that amount of time, which definitely wasn't, you know, 30 days. It took that time for me to like change my life, to really like even get to a place where I could like have some sort of plan.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So I do agree. And that's my story, you know, how it wasn't an overnight, like, oh, I admitted this. And then things just started changing. It was really,
That happens now and then. Some people wake up and stop drinking. But yeah, most of the time it's
I needed some convincing, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I needed some understanding, you know. Another thing I wanted to talk to you about now at Recover Integrity, do you guys work with dual diagnosis? Because that is very popular now, right? I mean, I wouldn't say popular, but it's being seen now. It's being understood. People are getting the knowledge of, co-occurring illness, you know?
Yeah, it's a different lens, you know? When I got clean, everybody's just kind of putting the addict alcoholic bucket, you know?
Right.
It was what it was. It was fine. That was the way that they understood everything. But as I've, you know, worked in treatment longer, and you start to develop a language to talk about kind of what's going on with people. You know, some people that are addicts and alcoholics and they have autism.
Right.
Okay. Well, if somebody has autism, you know, they definitely might need a different kind of treatment plan than somebody who doesn't have autism.
Sure.
Some people are schizophrenic. I mean, I remember when I went to treatment, there was a cat that used to walk around naked in the hallways who was pretty far out there. I didn't have the language to know that he was schizophrenic.
Right.
Or what should happen with him. It wasn't my job. I was just another, you know, client there or whatever. Yeah. But he was schizophrenic, you know? And so he was dual diagnosis. And there were certain medications that he would need in order to even have a chance at getting sober. Because if you're talking to the walls, it's going to be pretty hard for you to stay away from drugs and alcohol.
Yes.
Right? And so, you know, the vast majority of people that are coming off of drugs, whether it's because of the drugs or because of trauma and difficulties that they had, that they started getting high, you know, in the first place over, or at least why getting high felt so good, is because they had a lot of trauma. You know, the vast majority of people are coming in with some kind of dual diagnosis. The common ones are depression and anxiety. You know, I mean, but guess what? If you use drugs for a long time and you stop, you're gonna have depression and anxiety.
Yeah.
But on top of that, like, I didn't realize I was a depressed person.
Yes. That's
looking back. Yeah. I didn't really get that.
Right.
You know, I remember being 10 years old and I couldn't wait to go to sleep. Mm. Now I have a 10-year-old and my 10-year-old wants to stay up. They don't want to go to bed.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I remember I couldn't wait to go to sleep because I love to dream.
Mm.
There was something about life. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but looking back, there was something about life that was kind of painful for me. Now I know there was stuff going on in my house.
Mm-hmm.
It had an emotional impact on me that I didn't even know I had feelings back then. You know what I mean? And all that kind of stuff. So dual diagnosis treatment is, you know, it's a certain level of sophistication. You know, if you're in a behavioral program, you know, or if it's prison and you're yelling at some autistic, you know, young man because they don't pick up on body language, which some people with autism struggle with.
No,
you don't know what you're doing. Like, this person can't do it. Don't you get it?
He's not reading that. Yeah.
Somebody has really severe ADD.
Yeah.
And you know, so really, you know, tough issues controlling their impulses. Everybody's got some kind of ADD. That whatever. But some ADD, me too, right?
Yeah.
Some ADD is so bad that there's no impulse control. And so until you get a handle on that ADD, you know, how are they going to stop? And then psychosis. We have people, you know, that are coming in on mess psychosis.
Right.
And it's like, man, if you don't recognize psychosis and that they might not be group appropriate for a minute, like, don't kick them out for not being group appropriate. They're psychotic. They need to land. Doubt. You know?
I can't believe this this hour shot by this fast.
Oh, it was quick.
I had a whole thing that I just wanted to talk with you about and we didn't even get to it. I'm like really surprised this hour shot by. Hopefully we can have you back again in the near future. Would you like to tag anything? Would you like to tell people to follow you or where they can find Recover Integrity?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you guys at the Most High Show. This hour flew by for me.
Oh, man, flew by.
Thank you for having me and taking the time. I'm available. If you look at recoverintegrity.com, there's a hashtag recoverintegrity on Instagram. And, you know, if you need some help or you just need some guidance or you want some counsel or anything I can do, feel free to reach out. I'm very easy to get a hold of through either of those outlets, recoverintegrity.com or hashtag recoverintegrity.
Man, Yashai, man, it was a pleasure speaking with you. I could go on, man, but thank you. Man, it was an honor for us to have you, and we'll get back with you again, man, in the near future. I promise you that. All right.
That sounds good.
Everybody, thank you so much for spending some time with us, man. We had a great guest, man, giving us that West Coast perspective and, being able to tell us about recovery, how he's seen it, plus give us a little bit of his life story. So, this episode will be on the app, so make sure you download the Most High app. Plus, we have tons of different stuff on the app. You know, like I always say, it's a Netflix of recovery, you guys. You know, we appreciate you and bless you. Do you have the app?
I got it.
You got great.
I got it.
You'll see your episode pretty soon, all right?
We're gonna blow you up in Los Angeles. God bless you.
Do that. Take it easy, man. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, David.
Yep, later.
All right.
Yep.